The following sermon, entitled Crossing the Jordan, number 28 in the series on God's Church in the Wilderness, was preached on the evening of August 9th, 2020, at Hope Protestant Reformed Church of Redlands, California. For more information, please visit our website at hopeprc.org.
Let's open God's Word this evening to the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 3. Read the whole of Joshua chapter 3 and then also verses 10 through 19 of chapter 4. We read this as the conclusion of our series on God's church in the wilderness. We cannot leave you as a congregation in the wilderness. We have to get across into the promised land. Let's read Joshua chapter 3. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. It came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the host, and they commanded the people, saying, When ye see the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then ye shall remove from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Come not near unto it, that ye may know the way by which ye must go, for ye have not passed this way heretofore. And Joshua said unto the people, Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua spake unto the priests, saying, Take up the ark of the covenant, and pass over before the people. And they took up the ark of the covenant and went before the people. And the Lord said unto Joshua, This day will I begin to magnify thee in the sight of Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. And thou shalt command the priests that bear the ark of the covenant, saying, When ye are come to the brink of the water of Jordan, ye shall stand still in Jordan. And Joshua said unto the children of Israel, Come hither, and hear the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, Hereby ye shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Hivites, and the Perizzites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth passeth before you into Jordan. Now therefore take you 12 men out of the tribes of Israel, out of every man, every tribe a man. It shall come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that come down from above, and they shall stand upon an heap. It came to pass, when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, and the priests bearing the ark of the covenant before the people, and as they that bear the ark were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of the harvest, that the waters which came down from above stood and rose up upon an heap very far from the city of Adam, that is beside Zaratan, and those that came down toward the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. And the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan. And all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. Now we skip ahead to Joshua 4, verse 10. For the priests which bear the ark stood in the midst of Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to speak unto the people, according to all that Moses commanded Joshua, and the people hasted and passed over. And it came to pass when all the people were clean passed over that the ark of the Lord passed over, and the priests in the presence of the people. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh passed over armed before the children of Israel, as Moses spake unto them. About 40,000 prepared for war passed over before the Lord unto battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day the Lord magnified Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they feared Moses all the days of his life. And the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, Command the priests that bear the ark of the testimony that they come up out of Jordan. Joshua therefore commanded the priests, saying, Come ye up out of Jordan. It came to pass when the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord were come up out of the midst of Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up unto the dry land, that the waters of Jordan returned unto their place, and flowed over all his banks as they did before. And the people came up out of Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and encamped in Gilgal, in the east border of Jericho. We end our scripture reading at that point. The text for this evening's sermon is verses 14 through 17 of chapter 3. It came to pass when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, and the priests bearing the ark of the covenant before the people, and as they that bear the ark were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of harvest, that the waters which came down from above stood and rose up upon an heap very far from the city of Adam that is beside Zaratan, and those that came down toward the sea of the plain. Even the salt sea failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. And the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan, and all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over the Jordan. As pilgrims, we often grow weary. That is, as we travel through the wilderness that is this world in which we are living, there are times that we grow faint and tired, that our feet begin to drag as we press on in our sojourn. Maybe that's how we came to church this morning, staggering our way into the Sabbath day. And it's when we are weary as pilgrims that the thought of having to continue on, the thought of having to move forward, is quite daunting. It's intimidating. And this is especially true for many of us who recognize that, the Lord willing, we have many, many more years of traveling as pilgrims through this world. So what are we supposed to do when we grow weary as pilgrims? Well, a part of that answer is to set our hearts upon the destination toward which we are traveling. Because there are few things that provide a pilgrim more encouragement, more incentive to press on than the thought of arriving at his destination. It's the thought that there is an end and that it's a good end that spurs us on as we continue onward as sojourners here in the land below. And thus this evening we do just that. We focus on our destination. And specifically, we look at Israel's destination, the land of Canaan, to see at what it teaches us about our destination. And there's warrant for doing that because the promised land of Canaan is a type, a shadowy revelation of the destination that awaits us, that heavenly country toward which we are traveling. And that this is the case is evident from Hebrews 11, verse 16, which says concerning the patriarchs, "But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city." Hebrews 11, verse 16 teaches us that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not set their ultimate hope upon the land of Canaan, but that that land of Canaan was a spiritual picture of a heavenly country toward which they themselves were traveling. And that means by studying Israel's destination, we learn about our destination. And that includes the fact that before we can enter into that heavenly land, we must first cross one last barrier. For the Israelites, they had to cross the Jordan River. That's the history we read tonight in Joshua chapter 3, and it's that history and how it adds to the broader typology that we consider tonight. For it teaches us that there's parallels between the final barrier that Israel has to face and the final barriers that we must face as individuals and as a church before we can finally enjoy conscious glory with our God. Now, the comforting truth of Joshua chapter 3 is that our God does indeed bring us across the Jordan. He does bring us all the way home. So tonight we consider crossing the Jordan. Crossing the Jordan, that's the theme for tonight's sermon. First, we'll look at the destination, that is, what's on the other side, what we're aiming at, what we're going toward. Second, we'll look at the barrier standing between us and that final destination. And then third, we'll look at the crossing, the entrance into the promised land. We begin by looking at the destination. Weary pilgrim, there are six things that you must know about your destination, what's awaiting you when you cross that last barrier. First, you must know about your destination that it's a place of rest, of rest. And for those of us who are weary pilgrims, perhaps there's few things more appealing than the prospect of rest. This was certainly true for the people of Israel. They've spent the last 40 years wandering, traveling, walking through the wilderness, a most inhospitable place to live. And that whole time they had to dwell in tents, not in homes, but in temporary structures, things that they had to take down, carry along with them, and then set up again at the next campsite. And thus, for the Israelites, entering into the destination meant rest for them. It meant their sojourn was complete. No more traveling through the wilderness. It meant they could dwell in homes, permanent structures that God Himself would give to them, homes they would not even have to build. And so it is for us. There's a rest that awaits us. That's the teaching of Hebrews chapter 4, verse 9. There remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. And we will enjoy that rest when we arrive in heaven above. Revelation 14, verse 13 says about heaven, "And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, Write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors. And their works do follow them." What wonderful news for weary pilgrims. That when we reach our destination, what characterizes that place is that it's a place of rest. We will cease from our sojourning. We will cease from our works. And we will enter into our eternal dwelling place, our permanent home. But now that leads us to ask, tell me more about this destination. Describe it further. Well, the second thing you must know about your destination, weary pilgrim, is that it's a land of plenty. A land of plenty. For how was this was true for the Israelites? How was their destination? How was the land toward which they were traveling consistently described? A land flowing with milk and honey. That is a land of plenty, a land that would be fertile, that would give them all that they stand in need of. And even the 10 evil spies who brought back that evil report, even they had to acknowledge this. Even they had to say, it is a good land, and here's some of the fruit of that land as proof that it's a plentiful land. Well, so too is our destination, a land of plenty. And while this is no doubt going to be true physically, it's true, it will be true especially spiritually. For as Revelation 2 verse 7 tells us, we will be given to eat again of the tree of life. As Jesus Christ himself taught us in Luke chapter 22 verse 30, he will invite us to sit down at his table and to eat and drink with him with the bounties that he puts before us. And thus, as Revelation 7 verse 16 tells us, when we arrive in heaven, there will be no more hunger. There will be no more thirst. When we reach our destination, we're done with the days of scarce provisions. We're done with the days of barely getting by, either physically, but especially spiritually. Instead, we will enjoy the riches of glory and the bounties that Christ himself has earned for us by his death on the cross. Something to look forward to. But there's more. Because the third thing you must know tonight, weary pilgrim, about your destination is that you will possess this land as an inheritance. In other words, this wonderful land toward which we're traveling is not simply something that we're going to rent out for a time. It's not some land that we're going to lease from someone else, but it's going to be given to us as a possession. This was true for Israel. They would receive the promised land. It would not be like when they lived in the land of Goshen, that northern part of Egypt. They didn't own that land, but yet they lived there. Living in Canaan would be different. God himself would give them the land as an inheritance. And specifically, each family, each Israelite would be given a very specific portion, a definite allotment in that land. So it will be for us. We will receive an inheritance when we arrive at our destination. This is the teaching of 1 Peter 1 verse 4. There is an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you. Is that not something to look forward to, weary pilgrim? There's a plot in that heavenly country that awaits us with your name on it, reserved for you, waiting there. And God will give it to you. As a possession, a place where we will dwell for all eternity. What a thought. The fourth thing that we must know about our destination is that when we receive this inheritance, it will be accompanied by victory over our enemies. Victory. Victory is what stands out here in the book of Joshua for the people of Israel. Because the book of Joshua records for us the conquest of the land of Canaan, all those sweeping victories over all those different cities and all those different kings. Victories that came with Joshua leading the way before the people of Israel, so that for the Israelites, receiving their inheritance went along with, was accompanied by the defeat of their enemies and often the extermination of their enemies. And so it will be for us. We will enjoy victory when we arrive at our destination. Not a victory that we ourselves accomplish, not a victory that we win, but the victory of Jesus Christ Himself. A victory that means that we will have no more enemies. It means our days of fighting as soldiers will finally be done. We will be able to lay down our armor, casting it aside, and recognize that no more enemies means no more sin. I do not know about you, but aside from seeing Jesus Christ face to face, there is nothing that I'm looking forward to more than finally being done with sin. We will enjoy victory, the final victory, when we arrive at our destination. And really, the fact that for us there will be no more enemies and no more sin shows that our destination, the place towards which we're traveling, is vastly superior. It's better than the physical land of Canaan toward which the Israelites were now entering into. Because for them, they would still have to fight their enemies. They'd still have to conquer their foes on the other side of the Jordan River. And really, we know from what follows that they would never fully rid the land of their enemies. And added to that, there would still be sin. We see that almost right away, and especially when we come to the book of Judges, showing us that our destination, where there will be no more enemies, no more sin, is a far greater place to arrive at than what the Israelites looked forward to when they stood on the brink of the Jordan River. But yet there's even more. Because fifth, we must know tonight that we will dwell in this land with all of God's chosen people. In other words, it's not the case that we're going to receive this wonderful land, but then we're going to have no one to enjoy it with. We're not going to be alone. But instead, when we arrive in the promised land, we're going to enjoy perfect fellowship, perfect communion with all of God's people, His chosen people. It was true for the Israelites. Israel was God's chosen nation. Out of all the nations in the earth, God chose the Israelites and set His love upon them. And thus it was the nation of Israel that He brings across the Jordan into the promised land. But recognize, He brings an entire nation. He does not just bring the family of Jacob, those 70 souls that went down into Egypt, but He brings 2 million people into the land. Which means there was ample opportunity for the enjoyment of the communion of saints. And so it will be for us when we arrive at our destination. We're not going to go there alone, but we will join all of God's chosen people, an innumerable host. And now, unlike the Israelites, we will gather in the promised land with only those who are truly of Israel. The wicked are going to be excluded. Also, unlike the Israelites, we will enjoy heaven with a truly diverse people, a people made up of God's children from every nation, tribe, and tongue. As Jesus Christ Himself said in Matthew 8, verse 11, many shall come from the east and west and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. And it will be in that kingdom of heaven that we will enjoy communion, fellowship for all eternity, standing in with one another in praising our God, delighting in one another's company. But now there's even more. And we've saved the best for last. We're explaining six things that characterize the land toward which we're traveling. We said, first, it's a place of rest. Second, it's a land of plenty. Third, we're going to possess this land as an inheritance. Fourth, when we get this land, it will include victories over our enemies. And fifth, we're going to enjoy this land with all God's chosen people. But now, sixth and finally, weary pilgrim, you must know about your destination that God Himself will dwell there with you. This is what made the land of Canaan, the promised land, so special. Not that it was such a wonderful land from a physical point of view, but the fact that God Himself said He would live there. That He would dwell in the midst of His people as their covenant God, and that Israel, therefore, would worship God. It's really what the land of Canaan, especially the capital city, Jerusalem, was really meant for, was a place of worship. And at the heart and center of that worship would be those sacrifices, those offerings that God had prescribed for the people while they were still in the wilderness at Mount Sinai. The people would continue those sacrifices, continue bringing those lambs to the temple, first to the tabernacle, which would really be the basis for the fact that God would dwell in their midst. And so it will be for us. God will dwell with us in the land above. That's the teaching of Revelation 21, verse 3. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them. And they shall be His people, and God Himself shall be with them and be their God." And like the Israelites, when we arrive at our destination, we will worship our God there. When we scan the book of Revelation and see the saints who are already in heaven, what they're doing again and again, what's first and foremost for the saints is the worship of Jehovah God, and now specifically, the worship of the Lamb, the one who brought them there, the one who gave His life as a sacrifice so that we can have this fellowship with God, so that God would dwell in our midst. Doesn't this all sound wonderful? And the beauty is that this is not simply wishful thinking tonight. This is not speculation that we're saying tonight. This is not mere conjecture. This is the reality that awaits us. We will arrive at such a destination. But now thus far, in listing these six things about our destination, really, all that we've done is describe the land toward which we're traveling. We still have to identify that land. And that land is ultimately the new heavens and the new earth. In other words, our destination is not in the sense of the place where God dwells, nor is our ultimate destination the place where our souls will go when we die, that is the intermediate state. That's something different, slightly different. But instead, our destination toward which we're traveling that we've already described is what Scripture calls the new heavens and the new earth. That leads us to ask, what's that? Well, when Jesus Christ comes again at the end of all things, He is going to take this earth and He's going to burn it up with an intense fire. So much so that Jesus Christ could say that this world will pass away. From a certain point of view, this world is going to be destroyed because He's going to send a consuming fire upon it that's going to purge away all of the works of men and caused the world to perish in the same sense that the world perished in the days of Noah. Only at the end of all things, rather than using water to destroy the world, he's going to use fire to do it. But then, out of the ashes of that burned up world, he's going to recreate it. In other words, when he does destroy it with fire, he's not going to annihilate it. He's not going to so destroy it that it ceases to exist, but there's still going to be the substance there, and he's going to take that and he's going to transform it. He's going to make it new, the same way that our bodies, which will have returned to dust, will be formed. They're going to be made new. They're going to be glorified. The same thing's going to happen to this earth. And the end product is what we call the new heavens and the new earth. And what's so special about the new heavens and the new earth is that heaven and earth will be united. Right now we have two different realms, a place where God dwells and a place where we dwell, right here on this earth. When Jesus Christ recreates the heavens and the earth, he's going to unite them so that it's one realm, a place where God will dwell with his people. That's the destination. Those six things that we said at the start of the first point are all the description of this wonderful, wonderful land toward which we are traveling as pilgrims. It will be a land of plenty and of beauty that we will receive as an inheritance, a place that we will rest for all eternity. And there will be no more enemies, but only God's chosen people living together with our Savior, Jesus Christ. And what's important for us tonight, as we gather together for worship, as we sit out on the lawn, what's important for us tonight is to know that God has promised to give us that land. He made this promise to Israel. What do we call the land of Canaan after all? The promised land. Because God promised it to Abraham and then to Isaac and to Jacob. He reiterated that promise again and again and again. And now when we get to Joshua chapter 3, we see God keeps that promise. Even though hundreds of years have elapsed, even though Israel had to wait a very long time and endure many trials before they got there, God kept his promise. And so it is for us. He has promised you, child of God, that he will give you that inheritance. And he will keep his promise. He always keeps his promises that he makes to his people. And that gives us hope tonight. This gives us reason to press on as pilgrims, to persevere when the road before us is difficult. This is the encouragement we need tonight to continue sojourning through the spiritual wasteland that is this world. When we grow weary, we set our hearts upon the destination, and we let the thought of arriving at that destination be what spurs us on in our earthly sojourn through this life. But now, although we have this hope, we must also acknowledge that before we can enter into that promised land, there's one last barrier before us. There was a barrier for the people of Israel. The barrier between the people of Israel and the promised land was the Jordan River. And that's evident from the passage that we read. Verse 1, for example, places the people in Shittim. Joshua 3, verse 1, and Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan, that is the Jordan River. He and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. As we said last time, Shittim is the very last campsite. That means Israel is still on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So that If they want to get into the promised land, they first must somehow get across, pass over this river. And that means we need to know a little something about the Jordan River tonight and the Jordan River Valley through which this river flows. The Jordan River Valley extends from the Sea of Galilee in the north, where Jesus' ministry, the bulk of his ministry would take place, down south to the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, as it's called in this history. The river channel itself is roughly 80 to 90 feet wide, and the depth of the river is about 10 to 12 feet. And this Jordan River has a fairly strong current because of the elevation drop as you go from the north to the south. And what we must understand tonight is that this was a difficult barrier for the people of Israel to cross. Now, certainly, any river of this size would pose a difficulty for a nation trying to pass over. This would be a hurdle to overcome, but yet there's more to the difficulty than the fact that there's a river there. The difficulty is in part that the Jordan River Valley was packed with tangled bush and jungle growth so that they would have to make their way through a dense jungle on either side of the Jordan River. Added to that, there is the note about the river that we have in verse 15 of the text. Just as the priests are wading into the river, at the end of this verse 15, we have this parenthetical statement, this note that is put here specifically, right at the climax of this history. It's put here to call our attention to this fact. And what we read at the end of verse 15 is that, "For the Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of harvest." And that's telling us that at this exact time, this river was flooded. It was overflowing. And scholars who know a lot about this river tell us that during flood time, during harvest time, the river swells so that the width of the river, at least of the floodplain, is anywhere between 200 yards and a mile. Even if we take the short end, the narrowest spot, 200 yards is wider than this gate that we drive through when we come to church, and the back end of property, of the church property. Imagine standing at that gate and looking all the way to the back of the church property and seeing a river flowing with all of its force, so that, as one commentator said, this is not just some placid stream, but it's a raging torrent. And now remember who has to cross it. Not just a bunch of athletic young men dressed in swimsuits who are up to the task, but an entire nation. Men, women, children, and their cattle. All the while carrying their possessions. And now the point is, there was no way the nation of Israel could possibly cross this barrier. It was an impassable barrier. And Israel had to see that. If we ask the question, why does God bring Israel here at this time? Why doesn't he bring them during a drought? Why when the river is flooded and at its widest point? Well, the answer is, Israel had to know that of themselves they could not enter into the promised land. The only possibility of getting across is if God himself miraculously brings them across this river. She does that. For the people of Israel standing there right on the edge of the Jordan River, no doubt the thought of going across it was daunting, intimidating, fearful, something they were looking up against as they stood before this one last barrier. As we noted in the introduction, this teaches us about our final destination and the fact that there are barriers standing between us as pilgrims and that destination that awaits us. And this is true both from an individual point of view as well as collectively, that is, as an entire church of Jesus Christ. For us as individuals, that last barrier is death. Death is what stands between this life and the glories that await us. Death, that last great enemy. For the people of Israel, they have enemies on the other side of the Jordan River. First they have to get across, and then they have to worry about the enemies. For us, the barrier and the enemy are one and the same. We have to get through that enemy somehow before we can cross into conscious glory. And just as with the Jordan River, so also is death a difficult and a daunting barrier for us to face. Because of the pain that we know that it will involve. Pain involved with the rending apart of body and soul. There's the unknowns associated with it. We've never experienced this, and therefore it's intimidating to us. We don't know what it's going to be like. And then there's also the pain associated with leaving loved ones behind. Perhaps there's nothing more daunting, more grief-inducing than the fact that when we die, that means those earthly ties will be severed. We look up against that because there's still things we want to see and experience and go through with our loved ones. So that when we consider death, we are like the Israelites, standing on the banks of the Jordan River thinking, I have no desire to go through that. That's the barrier for us as individuals. But what about the church? What about the church as a whole? We say negatively that the barrier cannot be death, because death is what stands between us as individuals and the intermediate state, the state where our souls go when we die and our bodies lay in the grave. But we said that ultimately our destination is the new heavens and the new earth, and that the church as a whole must arrive at that destination collectively. So what then is the barrier between the church of Jesus Christ and the new heavens and new earth? Is there a barrier at all? And the answer is yes. That barrier is the great tribulation and the persecution that will take place at the end of all things. As a church, before we arrive at our destination, pass through the reign of Antichrist and all of the opposition that his reign will bring. As a church, we must first experience the nations of the world uniting against the church, seeking to destroy the church, making life miserable. It means we have to pass through, get across the horrible suffering and persecution that will take place. Persecution like the church has never seen before. Persecution that will involve martyrdom for the saints who are still alive in that day. That's the barrier. And perhaps there's no barrier that is more frightening than the great tribulation that will take place at the end of all things. As a church, we see that barrier getting closer. We're inching our way toward the banks of that last barrier. And as we draw closer and think about what awaits, we often tremble at the thought of it. And we begin to think, how can we ever get through? And in that way, by asking that very question, we're led to see exactly what the people of Israel had to see. That the only way across is if God Himself brings us over. If He carries us through. And indeed, He will. He will, just as He did for the people of Israel. For the people of Israel were indeed able to cross over. That's what this history in chapter 3 is really all about, the crossing of the Jordan River. Jehovah God Himself brought Israel across by performing a miracle. And we have a record of that in the text, verse 14 through 17. Following God's specific instructions, the priests of God took up the Ark of the Covenant and they brought it to the very edge, the very brink of the Jordan River, and they waded into the Jordan. That's what we read in verses 14 and 15. And it came to pass when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, and the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as they that bear the Ark were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the Ark were dipped in the brim of the water. So we have the priest entering into the river. And when they do that, God performs a miracle by causing the waters to stop. That's what we read in verse 16. That the waters which came down from above stood and rose up upon an heap very far from the city of Adam. In other words, there was a sort of invisible dam that held back the waters of the Jordan River. Perhaps they created a giant reservoir there. Perhaps they just got higher and higher and higher. And really, that's the impression we get when it says that they stood on a heap. It was as though there was this tower of water forming. And that invisible dam keeping back the water so that below would be dry land. That invisible dam was ultimately God Himself. That's what we read in verse 13 when God tells them what's going to happen. Verse 13, and it shall come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. God Himself would take His hand and block the waters of the Jordan River so that there would be dry land below. Meaning Israel could safely pass over. And indeed they did. Verse 17, the end. And all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. And then it was only when the priests who were standing there the whole time while all 2 million people go by, it's only when they go to the western side of the Jordan River that the waters finally return. That's what we read in chapter 4, verse 18. And it came to pass when the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord were come up out of the midst of Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up unto the dry land, that the waters of Jordan returned unto their place and flowed over all his banks as they did before. Notice here that means this whole history is bookended by almost the exact same miracle. Israel entered into the wilderness by passing through the Red Sea. The Red Sea, where God caused the waters to part so that Israel could pass safely through on dry ground. And now, at the very end of their journey, he does the same thing. Back, so that Israel can safely enter into the promised land. And now what stands out here, that this is God's work. Because what's the first thing into the river? The Ark of the Covenant, carried by the priests. That ark that symbolized God's presence in the midst of his people. That ark that pointed the people to the covenant of grace that he had established with them and that he had maintained with them and that he would perfect for them. What we have here, therefore, with the Ark of the Covenant going first as it's carried by the priests, what we have here is God himself acting with a view to the fulfillment of his covenant, with a view to the fulfillment of the promises associated with that covenant. Forms a sovereign work to open the way people might enter into the promised rest, their destination that has been awaiting them the whole time. And thus this miracle points us to the saving work of our priest, Jesus Christ. Specifically, it points us tonight to the fact that he provides a way for his people to cross the great barriers that stand between them and their destinations. Jesus Christ has done this with respect to death. For just as those high priests among the people of Israel were the first to go down the banks of the Jordan River and to wade into that river, so Jesus Christ has gone before us and subjected himself to death itself. He laid down his life and suffered his body to be buried in the grave. But death could not contain him. The grave could not keep a hold of him, for he arose again on the third day. And in doing so, he has opened up a way for us to pass from this life into conscious glory. So that death, what was that great enemy, that punishment for sin, is now the very thing that God uses to bring us to conscious glory. Death is that portal through which we pass, even as Israel passed through the dry land, so that they could arrive at their destination. Jesus Christ brings us through that barrier, the barrier of death. And so also, Jesus Christ will bring his church as a whole safely through the great tribulation that awaits at the end of all things. For although Antichrist will be given a great deal of power, nevertheless, he will still be under control, under the reins of the one true Christ. And though the saints who live in those final days will have to suffer intense persecution, the Spirit of Christ will be with us in that day, giving us the strength, empowering us to continue on. And then Jesus Christ himself will come on the clouds of glory. He will come for his church. He will take hold of us. And he will bring us safely across that last barrier. So that as a church, collectively, all together, we will enter into the promised rest. We will enter into the new heavens and the new earth. Pilgrim, are you weary tonight? Then fix your heart and your mind upon the destination that awaits. Let the thought of dwelling in that beautiful and wonderful land with your God encourage you to press on in this coming week. And as you do so, do not be afraid of the hurdles that you will face in this life, and do not fear that last barrier that awaits. Because Jesus Christ will bring God's church safely through the wilderness and into the promised rest. Amen. Our Father in heaven, we thank Thee for the comforting truths that Thy Word sets before us. We thank Thee for the opportunity that we've had for several months now as a congregation to study this history of Thy faithfulness to Thy church in the wilderness, and we rejoice that we can end where we have tonight with a message of hope that though we grow weary, though our lives are difficult, nevertheless, there is a rest that is waiting for us, a land of plenty where we will dwell with Thee for all eternity. Help us to set our hearts upon that destination and continue to carry us through this wilderness. Hear this prayer for Jesus' sake. Amen.